Hi, this is Against Everyone with Connor Abib. Well, friends, the past four episodes have been all about my favorite genre, horror, and I'm going to end this series with one final episode, which is a solo episode of me talking about the spiritual life of horror. If that sounds familiar to you and you're a longtime listener of the show, this is a repost of an older episode. However, I think it takes on new life in the context of the preceding episodes with some of my favorite horror creators: CJ Leed, Paul Tremblay, John Langan, Sophie White, Nathan Ballingrud, Sarah Gran, and Matt Carden. That's a lot of horror creators. On this episode, I wanted to give you a kind of summary of my thoughts about what horror is and what it offers. It's so often reduced to politics, that it's supposed to represent or just reflect on something that's already happening in the world. I think the offering is much deeper than that. And because I'm such a spiritually minded, motivated, and interested person, I'm going to present what I think is happening spiritually with horror. In addition to all of that, there are a lot of recommendations on this episode for horror stories and movies and books, as well as some poems and podcast episodes that you might not have heard of, even if you have looked at all those best of horror you've never heard of lists that come out every year around October. If you want to go deeper with any of those and go buy them or listen to the podcasts or whatever, look at trailers of the movies, I've linked to all of it on patreon.com/ConorHabib, where the show notes are, and you can also support the show. I also want to say, if you're new to the show and you've been listening for the horror episodes, there are so many more that are not in this series that I've recorded in the past, including episode 23 with Brian Evanson, where we talk about how horror is part of the self, or on episode 40 with Zachary Schomburg, who's a poet, and the theme of that is poetry scary? And the answer is yes. Also, episode 44 with Kelly Link and Jordy Rosenberg on how monsters are, in a lot of ways, their own kinds of theories set free in the world. There's episode 58 with Phil Hay, who co-created the excellent horror movie The Invitation, which is basically about a dinner party that goes horribly wrong. There's a sort of horror-adjacent episode with Maggie Nelson, who wrote an amazing book about violent art, difficult-to-watch art called The Art of Cruelty. And we get into some horror themes on that episode. I've also had Paul Tremblay on before. I've had Edward Parnell, who wrote a book about ghosts in landscapes, on episode 138. Ramsey Campbell was on episode 168. I mean, that was just a huge honor to have him on. And we talked about all the trappings and tropes of horror and what that means as a horror writer. And then I talked about why horror fiction matters as a release event for my book, Hawk Mountain, which came out last year in hardcover. And in some ways, this series is a celebration of the release of Hawk Mountain in paperback. But I talked about why horror fiction matters with Caitlin Doty and Mark O'Connell on episode 194. And that was a recording of a live event. Listen, there are even more episodes of this show on horror than that. But as you can see, it's an important force in my life and presence in my life, and I'm sure it is in yours too, which is why I really wanted to take it seriously and to re-present this episode in the context of having myself a horror novel out in the world and also talking with these other creators. So, this is my episode on the spiritual life of horror. Please do support the show, patreon.com/ConorHabib. We'll talk about horror more in the future, of course, but we're going to move on to different themes as we go. Every episode of the show is free. So your support matters immensely. If you are a longtime listener or a new listener who's just here for the horror stuff, your support is the only support that the show gets, listener support. I don't have any sponsors. I don't have any ads. I just have a relationship with you, the listeners, as the lifeblood of this podcast. Patreon.com/ConorHabib. Okay, pretty quick intro to this one on the spiritual life of horror. Here we go. First, let me say what is not interesting to me, or so interesting to me in exploring horror. Attempts to make horror a reflection of the dark times we live in. These are often trite explanations. They're the equivalent of evolutionary psychology for literature. If we just find the developmental mechanism for the organism, we can explain its behavior. If we just find the developmental origins of horror in politics or economy, current events, we can explain it. What could be more banal, really? It's not that I think these explorations are always wrong or offer nothing, but at this point, there are so many books on this, so many talks, lectures, university courses. In general, cultural studies has become overwrought, mostly because academia has very few pathways to producing interesting, heretical, worthwhile work anymore. But, you know, it's like in these books about horror, witches represent feminist concerns, and zombies represent peak oil fears or climate change fears, and vampires represent psychosexual repression. They all represent capitalism in some way. Sometimes these arguments will go hand in hand with the horror is hardwired into our brains argument, or I've even seen an essay saying that horror is pre-scientific. But of course, you know, it's still functioning in the materialistic age. It's not pre-scientific. It's alongside the scientific. And, you know, when we talk about horror as a reflection of our times, well, sure, current themes occur in all literature, whether we're talking about Jonathan Franzen or Kirsten White, but people are always reading and taking in horror that is not just about the current moment. We're just as thrilled by Dracula today as we were when it came out, maybe even more so. I don't know. And I think one of the problems about all this is that monsters effectively do not exist for these writers and thinkers. I don't just mean because they're only fictional, although that can be, you know, talked about as well as its own issue if someone's saying that. But it's worse than that. They're not even allowed to really be products of the imagination. They're rather loosely a sort of translated version of political economy. And, you know, I have, of course, seen horror narratives that play on the condition of, you know, primal horror. I'm thinking here of the excellent movie Backcountry, which is just about someone evading a bear. And there are blatant political commentary horror pieces that are often quite effective. There's the absolutely terrifying and brutal story, The Whimper of Whipped Dogs by Harlan Ellison. But is this all we're left with when we're going to look at horror, a whole genre that only finds its value in reflecting what we already know about the political or already know about evolution? Wouldn't that be so boring and also kind of a waste of time to just sort of translate it all into art just to say what we already know in some sort of other way? I think instead we can turn to horror as a longing and a reality. Not as a mere reflection of something, but something that allows us to reflect. And also as the expression of longing and something that has a spiritual effect within our being. And also has its own spiritual truth and reality. First, horror as a work of ontology, phenomenology, theology, the rupturing of what's real. Horror is one of the last genres or forms that allows us to engage with spiritual questions directly, without merely subjecting them to the world we know. So what I mean, horror offers up ruptures in materialism in many ways. So the lawfulness of the scientistic materialistic world falls away in horror so often. Some of the most obvious being that supernatural events take place, spiritual beings show up, the presumed laws of physics are broken, and more. So in a materialistic scientistic culture, we turn to horror to experience a sort of shock that reveals, even temporarily, the untruthfulness of the way we see the world from day to day. The untruthfulness of everyday life. The shock could be from a supernatural event. It could be from our bodies turning against us, like in Clive Barker's excellent story about hands, the body politic, where people's hands start turning against them. Or I'm also thinking of another kind of body horror story by Karen Russell called Reeling for the Empire, which is about people being kidnapped and turned into giant silkworms. But no matter what it is, we know going in that we're going to get something like that when we enter into a horror narrative. The genre itself is sort of a spoiler to say, look, theological, phenomenological, ontological ruptures are going to happen. You know, if we open a horror novel, we know something horrific will happen to its characters. This can be even if it's just the font. I mean, if you get a book and it has that sort of dripping or knife-shaped font or whatever, we know something terrible is going to happen. So if I see a book like Stephen King's Cycle of the Werewolf or a film 30 Days of Night, both instances of horror that I love, by the way, we already know before we begin that we're probably going to encounter situations where there's struggles with belief and the real. That believing and not believing is going to be something that the characters have to deal with. Surely werewolves don't exist. Surely vampires can't be real. And when we watch, you know, an interesting thing that happens, I think, is that we scold the person in the film for not believing. How could they not know? There's a werewolf killing people. These are vampires. All the signs are there. But, you know, watch that, because it's interesting how quickly we do that in films. But when it happens in our lives or with someone we know, we resist. If someone tells us that they've seen a ghost, a lot of times we laugh at them. And a ghost is one thing, but a werewolf is another thing. If someone tells you they've seen a werewolf, you think they're crazy. We struggle to ingest the lesson of being horror audience. The lesson of the horror narrative. And we don't take in the fact that disbelief won't save us. I talked about this a lot on episode 168 with horror writer Ramsey Campbell, that incredulity is no defense. And all of this also depends on what you believe and don't believe. So I met someone here in Dublin who told me, I mean, it was quite a horrible story, that he was convinced that his friend had been killed by vampires. Now, again, you might think, okay, ghosts, UFOs, whatever, but vampires? See, these are contours of horror. We encounter what we believe and where the fear comes in. Do we dismiss certain fears or accept others? And what does that tell us? You know, that age-old debate of slasher movies versus supernatural movies in horror. Which one are you afraid of, the serial killer or the vampire? Doug Bradley, who played Pinhead in the Hellraiser movies, wrote a very short essay in a good anthology about horror and religion called Scared Sacred. And he said, you know, he didn't find himself frightened by The Exorcist, but he was terrified by The Omen. Why? Are you connecting to the slasher in Angst, one of the greatest horror films of all time? Or are you connecting to the sort of desolate, fearful claustrophobia of the shipwreck in the horror series The Terror, which is also one of the greatest horror stories ever told? The possession of Come Closer by Sarah Gran, the plight of the child who's beleaguered by A Talking Evil Cat in Nobody Knows My Name by Joyce Carol Oates. Where does fear reveal to you the limits of reality, the limits of what you accept as possible, the boundaries of sanity? If you're the character occupying the state of not believing in a horror narrative, of not investigating fear and reality, you're usually fucked. You're going to be killed. As I said, incredulity is no offense. And there's a rupture too, another kind of rupture, that happens in our bodies when we watch horror, that happens in our physical rhythms. Well, not just our physical rhythms, just the rhythm of being. When we're scared, when there's a jump scare, for instance, we're driven into the experience of the motion and sound of physicality. It's an interruption to the rhythm when we jump, to our heartbeats, to our lungs. And what happens is a scream emerges, a gasp, a different kind of breath, a shuddering of our bodies. We jump. This jolt is a jolt to what occultists would refer to as the etheric processes. Our rhythms are interrupted and something new can happen. In that jolt, horror offers a branching pathway. Do you notice a lot of times when we jump, we laugh, right? So first we're scared, we're driven down into the processes of the etheric body and then back into a witnessing of what just happened. And when we're back in that witnessing, we laugh. Laughter is the sound that the body makes when consciousness is moved from Atman to Brahman, from the sort of everyday being self to the witness self. As we ascend that ladder, it's like a xylophone, you know, hit with the mallet on every step of the ladder on the way up. Ha ha ha, you know, this ascension. It's an instrument that chimes in the moment of revelation. That's what laughter is. There is no delight the equal of dread, is something a character from the Clive Barker story Dread says. Of course, delight without terror, I think, when it comes to dread, it misses something important. We also need to be terrified as we're delighted. I've never really liked horror aesthetics where there was this sort of worship of just the aesthetic or the ornament, the ornamentalism of it. It seems like a way to me of making horror ironic, so we don't really have to encounter it. I think there's something to be said about that sort of horror convention aesthetic thing. So this isn't a diss on the convention Halloween store aesthetics of horror, but since it only really appreciates the laughter aspect in a way, without ever really encountering the sort of dissent, if it's just an aesthetic choice, if it's just horror as accoutrement, then I don't think it really approaches some of the potential horror has. And, you know, we all know there are so many horror films that rely on the decorative nature of horror aesthetics. There are books too, but it's harder to do it in a book because we co-create as we read in a way that we don't do when we watch films. These films, they can't really evoke a real feeling of horror. I think some of these movies are good. They're good for their dark fantasy ornamentation. Dark fantasy. Not because, to my mind, they are fitting in with horror's potential. Part of this potential, I think, is training in discomfort. I talked about this on episode 58 with Phil Hay, who, along with his wife, Karen Kusama, and their creative partner, Matt Manfredi, created the 2015 horror masterpiece, The Invitation. That's a great movie about, basically, it's a horror movie about being someone who's into wellness culture from Los Angeles. The discomfort is an endurance, the enduring of discomfort generates the ability to encounter art. In some ways, I think horror audiences who ask themselves to endure discomfort are developing a capacity to enjoy the challenges of art. I think some people who really sit through horror and go through it, who say, I'm going to go into this experience to be unsettled, are better at taking in movies like, I don't know, The Exterminating Angel or Stalker or something like that. And by extension, I think even more equipped to deal with the challenges of the imagination and the spiritual. Of course, I know that someone who only likes a certain kind of horror accoutrement Halloween store aesthetic is not necessarily going to be equipped for all of that. Some people really just do like the ornament and the aesthetic. But for others, and here I'm reminded of Maggie Nelson's excellent book, The Art of Cruelty, or also just the Weird Studies podcast, the endurance becomes a transferable skill to appreciating art and to understanding the spiritual world. So in horror, we subject ourselves to something like a pain process. Through the jumps, through the disruption, through the discomfort, these processes allow us to encounter the spiritual. We even endure horror so we can witness and consider the absolutely hopeless. So many horror films give the message there is no escape. So much so that if we see a horror movie where things are resolved, that evade the classic tragic structure, we feel let down. Like, you see a movie, a Nightmare on Elm Street movie or whatever, and you're like, if Freddy doesn't come back at the end, you're like, where the fuck, why didn't he come back? We all kind of wait for the moment when the horror returns. We expect to be left with shock. I often appreciate this sort of horror the most, the horror that issues total brutality or a sort of closed-inness, an opacity. The question becomes, how would you find your way out of this evil? Is there a way? One of my very favorite horror stories, which is absolutely brutal, is called The Terrapin. It's by Patricia Highsmith, who people know better for writing Strangers on a Train and Talented Mr. Ripley, and a huge influence on my own thinking and work and just aesthetic life, really. About someone who, a kid and his turtle and his abusive mother. And in that story, the only way to escape the horror is through exacting more horror. This to me seems often, you know, the way people find their way out of horror. And it's not the right approach, of course, but it creates a powerful proposition that we get to consider. And it's one that we feel as we read The Terrapin. Melancholia, too, the film by Lars von Trier, is a great example of it, of this hopelessness of finding your way out. I love that movie. You know, in the first half, it's basically just about Kirsten Dunst and her depression and how she's struggling with the absolute depths of depression. And the second half of the movie really focuses on a planet, Melancholia, that's much larger than the Earth, that is going to crash into the Earth and absolutely obliterate it. Because it's much larger than the Earth, there's nowhere to go. And who's the person that's the best equipped to deal with this is someone who's dealt with depression their whole life, because there's no escape from depression either. So Kirsten Dunst's character is like, I've been dealing with this condition that you're just experiencing now all my life. Depression becomes a skill that lends something to somebody. Not to romanticize depression. The movie doesn't do that at all either. but it shows you that you are given something. There's, again, a powerful proposition there. Interestingly, I think the people who die in horror movies often have it a lot easier than those who live through it. I mean, in Rosemary's Baby, which is just a fantastic horror film, the living with what's happened after the film is over leaves us with a pretty distinctive and sickening note of terror. Or in the Phantasm movies, where we find out that the dead actually go on living as condensed workers in a labor hellscape. Or even in Hereditary, which is a film about emotional pain and suffering, living with what's done and what's happened. The horror of living. It's a spiritual warning against the singularity, you know, transhumanism, immortality, but also a revelation that there are fates worse than death, for sure. The defiance of death, getting past death, is a horror to us. There's, of course, the thing that can't die, like Jason, or, you know, in the Friday the 13th movies, or vampires, or whatever, but will kill us all. Immortality has its own terror. When we see immortality in action, we don't like it. There's a poem by Stanley McNeil called The Witch, which I'm going to read to you in a second. I just want to say that poems often have horror in them. We don't go to poetry enough for horror, but there's a lot there. This poem is in a collection called Fire and Sleet and Candlelight, which is rather rare. It's edited by August Derleth, but you know, the great cosmic horror writer August Derleth. But this poem is called The Witch. Each day she woke with sullen eyes and fanned away the circling flies. She breakfasted and left her lair with bitch red mouth and fish worm hair, a leather packet in her clutch, an evil poison in her touch, a jig, a curse, three spiteful words, and children's eyes were pecked by birds. One look at Goody Medford's farm, and all her cattle came to harm. One wave of that persimmon hand, and sickness settled on the land. The Salem folk could stand no more. They dragged her screaming from her door, and hanged her to a shrunken tree. At first she flopped, and then swung free. Homeward bound, they cheered and crowed, then met her coming down the road. It's great. Gives a little shiver, I think. It's no small thing, that poem. We want to be killable, or at least we want to be proximate to the dead. As Halloween approaches, we can sense the realm of the dead. So we become preoccupied with them, with death itself, and also the dead rising and living with us as a sort of undead being. In all these other ways. People talk about the veil being thin on All Hallows' Eve for Samhain. What does that mean? Well, monsters, first, the beings of dreams and nightmares, that astral plane, that dream and nightmare plane of emotiveness, of strange backwards images, we drape ourselves in their skin as costumes. We dress in an astral form, a frightening form. Since monstrous costumes aren't as frightening anymore, I mean, think about what would actually frighten us anymore as a costume. Maybe, I don't know, like I challenge myself to try to come up with what would be actually a scary costume now. Maybe someone just dressed as a burlap sack tied at the top. I don't know. It's hard to think of an actually scary costume anymore. Since monstrous costumes aren't frightening anymore, we start accessing the astral, that dream and nightmare place of feeling in a different way. We dress as sexy, again, to bring out the depth of feeling. We want the potency of that astral realm. The veil is thin in that way. It's also thin in the sense that we find ourselves surrounded by these images and costumes. The ghosts are all around us. The beings are all around us. It's like a reminder, hey, it's just over your shoulder. It's just right there. Now, this is a funny poem that I'm going to read, which is called The Worst by Shel Silverstein, but I love it just to sort of talk about what I want to talk about here. The Worst. When singing songs of scariness, of bloodiness, and hairiness, I feel obligated at this moment to remind you of the most ferocious beast of all, 3,000 pounds and 9 feet tall, the glurpy, slurpy Skakagrawl, who's standing right behind you. That poem scared me when I was a kid. It reminded me of that song poem, The Goblins Will Get You If You Don't Watch Out. Maybe all around us are spiritual beings and spiritual entities, monsters, ghosts, the dead. I mean, this is definitely true in time, if not in space. I mean, wherever you are right now, you're surrounded by corpses. People have died and been buried just a few feet from you, or maybe underneath where you're standing right now. Maybe not too far beneath you are the bones of the dead. So it's definitely true in time, if not in space. But I do think in space as well, that we are surrounded by spiritual beings that we just don't know how to read the room yet. We can't see them because we have no reference point for seeing. Is it that we can't see them that makes us frightened of them? What if we could see them? You know, there's that Paul Tremblay line in The Disappearance at Devil's Rock, which is my favorite novel by Paul. The devil lives in your peripheral vision. What would happen if we broadened our field of vision? What if when the veil is lifted, you can see better? When the veil is thinned, you can see better. What is filled there? What is in your field of vision now? And more than that about this veil, the veil is thin between ourselves and our doubles. What do I mean by that? Well, first, we see paradoxes coming together. Monsters walking the street, adorning our children's bodies, bringing happiness, being cute and sweet. Those kinds of paradoxes. But there are other ways. The two resolving into one. Not because contradiction is resolvable, but because it's held together. So we see in Hegel and Derrida and certain Marxist thinkers, and especially the Slovenian school of psychoanalysis, that there's a commitment to contradiction and paradox. And they say that there is no answer, that you just have to live with contradiction, but the human being is the answer. How does this relate to horror? Let me explain a little bit more. But the human being is the resolution of all paradox. The monster, the supernatural, is the question to reality, just as materialism is the question to the monster. The human being who holds a flow of antipathies and care for both brings them together. We bring together an everydayness and also a monstrousness, a supernaturalness, a spiritness. We live with our deadness and our life. We hold both. So contradictions do all resolve within us. And that brings me to part of this horror scene, this horror perspective of doubles. The double is the true figure of horror in some ways. It's the figure of horror. It has many guises. I'm thinking, you know, of different versions of it. So, for instance, in Dan Shaun's story, The Bees, where a man whose son is constantly screaming in the middle of the night is evoking or somehow strangely related to the fact that this man also had a complete double life with another wife and another son that he left behind and has never told his new family about. Or I'm thinking of Stuart Gordon's great film Stuck, which is about a woman who hits a man with her car, and the man's stuck half in and half out of the windshield, and she parks the car in a garage and just goes about her life. All the while, this thing is running in the background. That's a kind of doubleness, isn't it? Who we are in the everyday world versus who we might really be, the things that might be really going on, the dark things at play. This is, I think, what people are trying to get at when they point out that we're all capable of atrocity. You know, people say that all the time. Well, is there a big difference between you and the murderer? You and the person who killed other people in a nationalistic military? All that sort of stuff. There's always the potential for the double overtaking us. If we bring in the light of reincarnation, we would say not only are we capable of it, we have all committed unspeakable acts at some point, or we will. And none of that invalidates the fact that we mostly do not commit atrocity either. Even the most everyday, banal, boring, automatic aspects of existence, we don't harm others intentionally. But then again, what's your phone made out of? Where does it come from? What about the land you're standing on? What about the structures you're participating in all the time? We contain atrocity and we live our lives lovingly as well. And horror gives us the double in that way. And we often see this played out as a longing as well, especially in the works of Clive Barker, where the monster is a longing we have, the sexual longings of Hellraiser, especially the first two Hellraisers, or in Nightbreed, where we see the complications of being human. When we see these monsters that live in Midian in Nightbreed, we encounter the monster as something that's less horrific than the person. So we see a double there as well. And then we have one of the most clever explorations of the double, I think, which is in the film Funny Games. I deeply prefer the remake, the shot for shot almost remake, by Michael Haneke. I know that's heretical to say that I like the remake more, but anyway, it's such a clever exploration of the double, because we as the viewers become the double in some ways, the sort of impelling evil force. There's such a deep truth in that movie, that evil performs for us, so we notice it, and it's always asking, do you want us to do more? There's a moment where the two murderous people in the movie, basically they turn the camera and one of them says to us, the audience, isn't this what you wanted? Isn't this what you wanted to see? Isn't this the story you wanted to get out of watching this horror movie? And then goes back into the film and starts harming everybody in it. And no matter what they do, they can't get out of their circumstance because we're watching it. We're the evil other, responsible for the brutalization of other people. The same in the excellent and very disturbing novel, The Sluts by Dennis Cooper. There is no delight the equal of dread. The next line in that story is, as long as it's someone else's. The being of the double, that horror being is within us. In occultism, there's this idea of the Aramonic double. These difficult beings, Ahriman and Lucifer and some other evil beings, they actually are part of a composite, a part of us. They live in us. They're an aspect of us, and they had to be there for human evolution to unfurl the way it has. And these Ahrimanic doubles within us, they long to make the horror in the world horrific but with no exit, a total materialistic horror. They would like to turn everything into matter and motion. We all recognize this aspect of ourselves. This aspect that will be convinced that the world is nothing but stuff, that there's no moral or ethical imperative or purpose. There's no such thing as good and evil. Even love itself is just brain chemicals. This double within us, marked by occultism, is something that has hidden itself. It had to hide itself so we could get into this era of being human, with all our science and our separation of our thoughts and our feelings and our actions, so that we could grow. But I won't go into this concept of the Ahrimanic that much longer, or into that much detail, because it's quite complicated. But just to say, you know, there's this hiddenness to this being, and when we watch horror, we can see what we're up to and why with this double that lives in us. We can see monsters that don't care about human life. We can see the screaming in terror for pure survival at the expense of having any sort of spiritual life. This is a moment that comes up in a lot of apocalyptic horror movies, where you see people, you know, in a zombie apocalypse, you know, putting down the forks and knives and setting the table nicely in the one farmhouse that they found. And there's a character who's like, what's the point of doing that? We're in the end of the world. And the person who set the table nicely is like, this is all we've got is human dignity. But it's true in a way that there's this sort of moral and ethical thing that might go deeper than the physical circumstances that this double would like us to forget about. Horror is something that allows us to examine and think about that. Horror is a crystal that contains evil so that we can look at it without it fearing that it's going to escape. To the total contrary of people who condemn horror narratives as contributing to making the world a worse place, we don't really have much of a shot of really looking at evil without them. So, evil cannot exist in the world without response or dismissal. What do I mean by that? Like, if you see something terrible happening outside or like just, you know, a few feet away from you on the street, you've got to do something about it. Or if you see it on the news and you feel like you can't do anything about it, you just dismiss it. So you've either got to respond or dismiss it. That doesn't really give a lot of time for reflection. But horror can contain evil in many forms, so we can conceive of it with thought and contemplate it and meditate on it, even if we're cautious and protect ourselves with, I don't know, the Beatitudes or some sort of other ritual going in. Rudolf Steiner said that the more the double appears, the better it is for our development, for otherwise we would be living under great delusions about ourselves. The eye of horror leads to compassion and love, ultimately. The portal of horror that we pass through, that eye of seeing, it leads to compassion and love. One of the most beautiful instances of this is one of my very favorite horror films, which remains unknown. It's called Eclipse, and it was directed by Conor McPherson, the Irish playwright, and written by Conor McPherson and Billy Roche. And it's about someone who's seeing ghosts of people that haven't yet died. And they're sort of heralding this strange presence that needs to be encountered. And it, first of all, it takes place at a literary conference in Ireland. So, of course, I'm going to completely love this movie. I'm predisposed to love it. But it ends up being such a beautiful meditation on grief and connection with the dead. And yet the scary parts are truly terrifying. They're very scary. And horror then leads us, in this instance, to a reflection of our relationship with art, our relationship with the dead, our relationship with terror, our relationship to the cruelty of we inflict on others and that we allow others to inflict on us. One of the co-hosts of the Weird Studies podcast, who I've mentioned before, and I've had them on the show, and J.F. Martel, who hosts the show along with Phil Ford, said, "We save ourselves in reality by damning ourselves in art." If we condemn ourselves in art, we get to actually do something that can change the course of things, that can help us direct reality, which is reflect on evil, reflect on the double. Horror, considered with spirit and love in mind, is our spiritual liberator.